Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week two guests, Amanda Bass and Aman Singh. Amanda is a third-year student at NYU, the New York University School of Law, and Aman is a second-year law student at NYU, and they are organizers of a statement denouncing the school's hiring of Harold Coe. And we will find out who Harold Coe is and what's the matter with hiring him at NYU as we proceed. Amanda and Aman, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having us, David.
Thank you.
Whichever one of you wants to begin, who is Harold Coe?
So Harold Coe is someone who, between 2009 and 2013, was the legal advisor at the State Department. And in that capacity, he was one of the legal architects for the Obama administration's targeted killing program. And in 2010, on March 25th, 2010, gave a speech before the American Society of International Law, where he, for the first time, revealed the Obama administration's legal rationale for these targeted killings. And he's someone who, between 2009 and 2013, publicly defended the Obama administration's drone program's legality. And so we felt that, you know, him coming to teach human rights at NYU Law School, given his role as someone who has publicly defended the drone program, and as someone who played a role in shaping its legal architecture, was inconsistent.
Now, this is a law school, and you're talking about a lawyer giving reasons why something is supposedly legal.
Right.
What's the problem with that, Aman?
Well, the problem isn't just that he gave advice. I think the problem that we would pinpoint is that he played a role in creating a program that broke the law. So it's not so much after the fact defending a program or giving arguments for why it may or may not be legal. You know, if it was just, you know, the few speeches he gave after he left office, this clearly wouldn't be an issue. The issue is the role he played, again, in developing the program that is illegal.
There is overwhelming evidence that the U.S. drone program does violate a whole host of international human rights and humanitarian laws. And a number of those sources we cite to in the text of our petition. One of them includes a 2010 report authored by Philip Alston, who at that time was the special rapporteur on extrajudicial summary and arbitrary executions, in which he identifies the drone program as applied by the United States as in violation of the United States' obligations under a variety of humanitarian and human rights standards. So it is that Harold Coe defended and helped to craft a program that, by all accounts, does violate international human rights and humanitarian law.
You actually cite in your letter condemning the hiring of Harold Coe to teach at NYU a report called Living Under Drones that was produced by law professors, I believe, at NYU as well as Stanford. A woman from formerly at Stanford, Jennifer Gibson, has been a guest on this program discussing it, and that paints a rather horrible picture of the drone program, does it not?
What's really ironic about the situation is that, yes, it's our very own clinic, our very own faculty. I mean, Philip Alston, who was just mentioned, is also a professor at New York University. And so this report that you've mentioned really lays out not just the legal violations, but also the moral problems, you know, that even, you know, parts of the program that are, quote-unquote, of questionable legality, or there can be arguments made, they still resulted in civilian casualties. They still, at times, failed to properly discriminate between a combatant and a non-combatant. I think part of what we're trying to do here is to create a conversation about the role of human rights lawyers in legitimizing these abuses when you have someone like Harold Coe at the table In many ways, it blunts the criticism afterwards of, you know, whether a program was, one, legal, and two, morally acceptable.
Yeah, what struck me about that report was that, you know, beyond the fact that the vast majority of the people killed are not in any way fitting the description of the people supposedly targeted. Most of them are civilians by anybody's definition, and most of the rest are identified by sort of profiling, not by identity, much less are they charged and convicted with some sort of crime. But that the majority of the victims are not those killed, but those traumatized by these murder weapons hovering over their heads day and night. We don't hear much about that in the United States.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. And I think that that goes to just the overwhelming human costs of this program that often, I think, gets lost in the sort of debates about the drone program's legality. I think, you know, it's important to be able to sort of have a conversation about, you know, the ways in which the program is violating, you know, international human rights and humanitarian law. But I think when you look at the human costs and the sort of moral costs of this program, beyond just the people who are targeted and killed, there are also people who are injured physically and also psychologically through this program that Harold Koh helped to shape, which he publicly defended, and which ultimately our tax dollars fund.
Particularly when the people creating this program and carrying it out are, quote-unquote, our people, you know, that are claim the mantle of being human rights attorneys or human rights advocates or claim to represent the left, we should be, you know, all the more willing to step outside of the constraints of the law and not just say that, you know, is something in violation of the law or not, but is it morally acceptable? Acceptable for, and is it morally consistent with the principles that these people claim to uphold?
It seems like where there has begun to be the sort of glimmer of a beginning of a debate in the corporate media has been when U.S. citizens have been targeted and killed with U.S. drones. I think we know of at least four such cases, and in one of those four, some sort of pseudo-defense has been offered, justification has been offered by the White House, and Harold Koh played some role in that. Can you talk about Harold Koh's role and whether there actually is a graver legal offense when the victim is a U.S. citizen?
Right. Well, so another source that we cite in our petition is Jeremy Scahill's book, Dirty Wars. And in that, he does describe, also citing Daniel Kleidman's book, Killer Capture, as well as leaks upon which Kleidman relies, to describe Mr. Koh's role in, you know, facilitating Anwar al-Awlaki's assassination. He was essentially tasked with providing the sort of legal standard that would make Mr. al-Awlaki's assassination allegedly, you know, constitutional and consistent with the laws of war. And so, you know, I do think that there are concerns that come to play when you're targeting a U.S. citizen who has constitutional rights. And so you're not just thinking about whether or not this targeted killing is legal under international human rights and humanitarian law, but also under the U.S. Constitution. But I do think that, you know, sort of the discourse around the targeted killing of American citizens does highlight, I think, the ways in which this program is also just, you know, result of this vast expansion of executive power that we've seen under the Obama administration. And it is troubling that an administration would have no qualms targeting a U.S. citizen who does have rights under our Constitution. It makes it all the more troubling that they would target people who don't have those same constitutional rights, namely people in Pakistan, in Yemen, Somalia, and elsewhere.
And my understanding from Scahill's reporting, al-Awlaki was on the list of people to be murdered before the events occurred that that are used as the legal justification for putting him on that list. Is that correct? And is that sort of after the fact justification something a good liberal lawyer should be doing?
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, I think that, you know, that is also my understanding as well. You know, he was put on the kill list prior to, you know, him sort of being labeled this sort of imminent threat. But I think that, you know, it goes to, I think, the just lack of transparency and accountability around this program. So there is essentially no way for, you know, us as American citizens, as the public, to really see the standards that the U.S. government and government officials are using to put people on kill lists. You know, you mentioned earlier that sometimes they just use metadata to essentially target people based on patterns of behavior or phone calls made, and that's extremely troubling. And I think it goes to another dimension of the program's illegality, which is its lack of transparency, its total lack of accountability, and those are themselves violations of, you know, the U.S. obligations under international humanitarian law.
It was interesting to me. I want to get to your letter and what's happened around it. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting to me that the only abuse you cite for Harold Coe is the drone program. I mean, I remember Harold Coe going into Congress and telling them, we will let you know if we're having a war in Libya after the fact. And it won't be a war unless we say it is. And it won't be anything under the War Powers Resolution. It won't even be hostilities. These will be friendly bombs. Because U.S. troops won't be on the ground, although, of course, they already were. I mean, is all of that sort of thing okay, or are those problems as well for Harold Coe?
No, those are absolutely problems. You know, and we have, for strategic purposes, chosen to focus, you know, on Mr. Coe's involvement in the drone program, but you're absolutely right. Like, there are many other very troubling aspects of Mr. Coe's record. Not only his support for the U.S. bombardment of Libya and his argument against people like Jay Johnson that this was not hostilities and therefore not a violation of the War Powers Resolution is really very troubling. He is someone who, you know, also worked in the Reagan administration in the early 1980s in the Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel, and there are questions about the role that he played in justifying the U.S. Military intervention in Grenada. There are a lot of questions that, you know, that I think we have been asking about who is Harold Coe and who is this person who is held up within the sort of liberal human rights mainstream as a model for a human rights lawyer. So you're right, it's absolutely not just limited to his role in shaping and defending the drone program.
We are speaking with Amanda Bass and Aman Singh, law students at NYU, a school that has hired Harold Coe to teach law, of all outrages. So, Aman, you have produced this letter. What has been the response in terms of positive and negative interest?
Well, so the response has honestly been quite surprising. So we've had a few professors. One professor immediately after the petition was released emailed the signatories individually with a very kind of strong case trying to persuade them to take their signatures off of the petition. And this is a professor that, you know, many of the signatories have a class with or are doing research under. Afterwards, there was a different professor who emailed the entire law school community, again, you know, strongly urging students to remove their signatures from the petition, making arguments, you know, defending Harold Coe in terms of his whole record and telling everyone to, you know, look at other aspects of his record where he did stand up for human rights, particularly, you know, before he was in office. But, you know, not really addressing the primary concern of the petition being his role in the specific violation that was cited, the drone program that targeted killing. And the, you know, the intimidation, and we call it intimidation particularly because, you know, the response has included, of course, some, you know, productive expression of views and offering, you know, some criticism and pushback that is, you know, inherent to any intellectual debate, particularly at an academic institution, particularly at a law school. But what we found is inappropriate is when professors are pressuring students to back off from a political position, to change a stand that they've taken, which is, you know, what they've done when they've asked us to remove our signatures from the petition. And so this has also included emails from a former supervisor of one of the organizers. One of our organizers worked at, you know, a very prominent human rights organization, and the head of that organization emailed the organizer with, you know, calling the person late at night, again, urging them to take their signature, to not take part in this campaign.
What organization was that?
It's the Southern Center for Human Rights.
The Southern Center for Human Rights.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It seems like to me whenever these sorts of people get hired, I mean, people who have very notoriously committed crimes in high office, from John Yoo to David Petraeus to Harold Koh, even though they're being hired not to participate in a debate but to teach students, the schools always shout about academic freedom. Is that what's at issue here, academic freedom?
No, I would think it's not, because we're not saying that Harold Koh said something or expressed a view that we disagree with. We're saying that Harold Koh did something that we disagree with, that he did something that was in violation of the law and resulted in death, that resulted in people being killed, that resulted in persecution. So the academic freedom argument, I think, is completely off base. Because again, we're not talking about the content of speech. We're talking about action.
So, Amanda, who is this letter addressed to, and what are you asking them to do?
So, the letter is addressed both to NYU Law School Dean Trevor Morrison, as well as to the president of NYU, who formerly was John Sexton, and there's been a change in the administration. But we're essentially expressing our dissent with the law school's decision to bring Harold Koh to teach specifically this course, this doctrinal course, to, you know, law students who are being introduced to the field on international human rights, particularly for the reasons that Aman mentioned and that you also mentioned earlier, which is, you know, someone who has been in government and has committed crimes, you know, and sort of justified that through the rubric of human rights is not, in our view, qualified to be teaching students an introductory course on human rights law. And so we're essentially just expressing our dissent, and we're not articulating any particular demand. We're not asking for Harold Koh to be fired. We're not asking for his teaching to be interrupted. Which has also made the administration's and some faculty's response pretty alarming, simply because we are articulating just as our sense of disagreeing with this decision, not putting forward any demand, and yet even still we are met with this response, this overwhelming response from the administration and from some faculty urging us to withdraw or withhold support.
Do you think that Harold Koh should, rather than be being hired, should be facing criminal prosecution?
You know, I think that that's an open question. I mean, and hopefully, you know, that's something, you know, that can be discussed and debated. You know, I think that part of our goal in writing this petition and raising our voices about this is to be able to get to those tough questions, like, you know, so how to hold individuals like Harold Koh accountable for their actions in government. I don't think we can get to that conversation until we sort of essentially raise our voices condemning his presence within, you know, our law school teaching human rights and highlighting that there is a problem. So hopefully, you know, the conversation can move in the direction that you're suggesting.
And if I could chime in, you know, as Amanda mentioned, we're not asking for Harold Koh be fired. We're not even demanding that he shouldn't be allowed to teach at the university. We're just saying he shouldn't be allowed to teach international human rights because he took part in violating international human rights. And I think for us, you know, one of our primary goals really is to create a conversation. And that's why the response of the administration and faculty has just been so alarming, because, you know, they're kind of saying, no, you can't have this conversation, or you shouldn't have this conversation. And it really speaks to what I think is an institutional failure to live up to its commitments to public service, to social justice. And, you know, this is one case of it, you know, but you know, recently there's also been controversy around NYU's campus at Abu Dhabi and a lot of labor abuses that have happened there. And, you know, there have been 3 years of campaigning and advocacy and outreach to our president, John Sexton, without him even offering to meet with the organizers of that campaign. And so, you know, it just speaks to just a real failure of this particular institution and, you know, probably other universities as well to prioritize human rights, to prioritize social justice and public service, even though they are exploiting those values, those causes to draw students, to draw funding. They're presenting themselves as institutions that uphold those values, but are doing everything they can to violate them, to not care about them.
It seems like when lawyers in the White House and the State Department did things about the same or not quite as bad as what Harold Koh did, but did them for a Republican president, the outrage was more widespread and accepted. If Harold Koh had done the exact same things under a Republican president, do you think you would be making more headway? Is it the Democratic Party label that's helping to protect him?
Yeah, I absolutely think so. I mean, and that's also part of what's astonishing about, you know, not only just the overall silence that we've been, you know, trying to break and with respect to Harold Koh and his role in the drone program, but also with the responses in support of Harold Koh that are coming from, you know, liberal human rights lawyers, you know, who I think would have been vocal critics of the same policies under a Republican administration. I think one of the things that's also really astounding is that Mr. Koh himself was a critic of Bush-era executive abuses and was a critic of the vast executive power that was evolving under the Bush administration and then, you know, goes into the Obama administration and takes that, runs with it and goes even further. So I do think that, you know, in this whole process, we're seeing the sort of, you know, party politics play out and party loyalties play out. And we're essentially saying, you know, it's not enough that he's a liberal Democrat, you know, that doesn't shield him from critique. You know, there are principles that, you know, that should be grounding us. And so that is why we're critiquing Harold Koh and his role, even though, as Alman said earlier, he is regarded as sort of one of our own in the human rights arena, as someone who cares about human rights, who's a, you know, liberal lawyer, who we shouldn't be criticizing.
It seems like the best of the liberal lawyers that meet the low standard of being, you know, bad enough to testify in congressional hearings these days, people like Mary Ellen O'Connell and Rosa Brooks have sort of accepted that as a special rapporteur at the UN. Now Ben Emmerson has said in a report that war is now normal. Drones have made war normal. The challenge is to make it acceptable and transparent, and where a drone murder is part of a war, it's okay, but where it's not okay, and so we have to see the secret memos that tell us whether it's part of a war or not, to the point where Rosa Brooks has now argued for sort of permanent wartime, eliminating any distinction between peacetime and wartime. I mean, this seems to be the direction that liberal lawyers in academia are going, at least most prominently. Is this an acceptable direction? Or do we actually need to stop murdering people with flying robots?
One thing I would point out is I think it, you know, particularly when we're talking about human rights, in many ways this movement, this cause, is supposed to step, you know, outside the bounds of the two-party dynamic and outside of the liberal versus right versus conservative. And so for us, I think our focus isn't just that, oh, we want to hold liberal lawyers accountable. We want to hold lawyers accountable. We want to hold anyone accountable who's taking part in a human rights abuse, and particularly when that person claims to be part of our human rights community, we think it's all the more necessary. And in regards to, you know, whether, you know, individual professors have you know, I'm not sure that's something we want to comment on, particularly, you know, not being completely familiar with Professor Brooks and Professor O'Connell's, you know, testimonies in Congress. But just to speak on, you know, the general issue, you know, it, in many ways, yes, the having the mantle of being a liberal lawyer, or being a human rights lawyer, you know, it allows them to be shielded from criticism that they shouldn't be. And, you know, this is particularly the case with Harold Coe, where, you know, at our university, you know, as soon as we started talking about, hey, maybe this isn't a great idea, hey, maybe this doesn't make sense to hire this person to teach this class, you know, the response was a very aggressive, you know, rebuke from our colleagues, from the liberal students and lawyers that, you know, we agree with on almost every issue. And so it really is an illustration of, you know, how sometimes maybe, you know, somebody from your own side is actually more dangerous than if that same policy, than if that same, point of view was being expressed to somebody from the other side.
Yes.
And just to jump in quickly, you know, I think that the sort of trend that you and Aman also identified, which is the sort of way that liberal lawyers are also contributing to, you know, to increase violence by the U.S. government abroad, are sort of facilitating that. I mean, one of the panelists at the event that we're planning for this month is Chase Madar, and he will essentially be talking about this phenomenon, which he terms the weaponization of human rights, and the way that you do have, you know, liberal lawyers who, through the rubric and the rhetoric of human rights, are allowing or sort of enabling the United States government to use violence and force abroad, and to justify intervention, to justify, you know, murder. So I think it is a really troubling trend, and that's also one of the larger, you know, points that we want to make, which is we have a problem with the sort of mainstream liberal human rights movement moving in this direction. And so this is why we're raising our voices to say we want accountability from, you know, individuals like Harold Coe who contribute to that phenomenon. We'd like to reimagine a human rights movement that is not, you know, an enabler of U.S. imperialism and militarism and violence in the world.
Very, very well said by both of you. Less than a minute left. Where can people go to find out about your future events, to read the letter, to get involved and help out?
So we created a website. It's rethinkco.wordpress.com. So that's rethinkco.wordpress.com.
That's co spelled K-O-H.
Yes.
Wonderful.
And we'll also be having an event on April 20th, the law school. It'll be a panel event talking about drones and the role of progressive liberal attorneys in legitimizing extremism.
With Chase Madar, among others, who's also been a guest on this program. Amanda Bass and Aman Singh, thank you for everything you're doing and for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much for having us.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.